previously.tv podcast network.
Where are all the football stars? And where are the biochemists? They're trapped. Trapped in the soft, vice-like grip of robot lips.
Farewell!
The next day, Billy's planet was destroyed by aliens. Have you guessed the name of Billy's planet? It was Earth. Don't date robots!
Brought to you by...
Space Pope.
This is the Extra Hot Grape Podcast, episode 201 for the week of April 23rd, 2018. I am Indian Scalp, we call it Maze Tattoo, David T. Cole, and I'm here with Symbolic Hand Tremor, Sarah D. Bunting.
I'm sure it's just too much caffeine, right? Too much caffeine?
Hedonism Bot, Tara Ariano.
I trust the orgy pit has been scraped and buttered.
And feckless narrative writer, Eve Beatty.
Why am I still alive? Why am I still alive?
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another week of Extra Hot Grate. We are rejoined by Eve Beatty.
Hello.
Eve.
Yes! Yeah!
Thank you, who is very ably recapping Westworld for us at previously.tv, and I think may share my exasperation with the show. But first, your exasperation with our show may extend into next week. We are taking the week of April 30th off so that Dave and Tara can transplant themselves back on the mainland. Other podcasts will also be off. Just check your feeds. Thank you for your patience during this annoying time. Okay, Westworld. Eve.
Yes.
How, I did not watch season one, and yet I still feel various extremely strong ways about the two episodes of season two that I have watched.
This is good because I've only watched the first two episodes too, because I'm trying not to get ahead of watching what I've recapped. So we're on the same page with that.
Me too.
Okay.
But, I also watched the first two.
Okay, but I didn't watch the first season.
Oh.
So I'm wondering if, well, I'm not wondering if I should go back and watch it because, spoiler, I'm not going to. but I'm wondering if the things that seemed to irritate you in your recap of at least the season premiere of season two, to wit, various like college dorm room dialectics about the nature of reality and dreams, were also present in season one, or if this is this like just so much, you know, recapping, leave it to the professionals, or is this something that the show has always done?
I feel like there's definitely a lot more sort of lecture hall explainy stuff going on. But I also think that, you know, when you're sort of neutral to okay with somebody and they do an irritating thing once, you're just sort of like, okay, no big deal. But when they continue to do that irritating thing, you start to really dislike them.
Gotcha.
And that's how I feel about the show.
Ah, okay. Was there anything else on your undateable list, basically, about this show that was continuing to recur in the second season?
Well, I tire of the sort of a elliptical, like, something's happening, something's going to happen, you guys, but we're not going to say what it is. And, like, I understand if it's all supposed to sort of be allegorical or whatever, but I wish you would just sort of say, it's starting to feel like those British farces where no one explains that that's their sister and not their wife or whatever. Just, you know, say, all right, well, we have to do this or we have to go over here or whatever. You know, it doesn't have to all be like, oh, I'm going to do something. I'm not going to tell you what. Maybe you'll get a glimpse of it by the end of the episode.
And then they kind of cut away to someone gazing into the middle distance and talking about the splendor of it all. I mean, I don't know. I thought things picked up in episode two. So listeners, you'll, I guess, have that to look forward to. But
oh, see, I hated episode two even more. I'm sounding very negative, but I feel that you led me that way, Sarah. So I blame you.
Who,
but
me?
I'm interested, though. It's interesting, even though I'm irritated. Like, I don't know. Like, I don't like eavesdropping on a weirdo's conversation at the table, like over from you or something. Like, I'm interested and I'm enjoying recapping it. I'm not just saying that because you guys are my bosses. Like, I'm having a good time writing it. I think that everyone will have a good time reading what I write. But at the same time, I'm just sort of like, so what? Why do you think that all of this is a good idea? And are we actually going anywhere? I'm very concerned that we're in a situation where, what's the phrase? You know, like 2 pounds of plot in an 8-pound bag or something. I already feel like we're spinning.
Yeah, I mean, I did like the episode because there was a lot of world building there, but I did also feel like some of the time shifting was a little bit like they were stalling.
Yeah.
The show is frustrating for me based on what I have seen so far, because I like the majority of these actors, and then mm-hmm. I feel like they're being given garbage lines like, I used to see the beauty in this world, and now I see the truth. Like, bless Evan Rachel Wood's heart. She's very talented. I've enjoyed her in other things. But between the Mancorama wigs of the future, like, give me a break. They've perfected Android technology. They can't do a proper weave. Come on. This is HBO.
Yeah.
And the, like, sophomoric proselytizing about, you know, everyone puts their foot in a different river, like, uh-huh, and then they turn 19. I know you're just getting consciousness, but shut up. Tara,
do
you agree with this assessment? Did you watch season one? What are your thoughts?
I forget when I bailed on season one. I definitely watched the premiere, and then from there I thought, nah, this isn't for me. But the thing to remember about that is that it was in the fall of 2016. It's taken all of 2017 off, and I don't know if it's that the show is different or I am different or both. But my my take on this after the first episode, as it so often is Dave, I regret to say, can attest, is, oh, this is about capitalism. And I still think that's true.
Yeah.
The similarity. I mean, Eve called a lot of this out, mostly with regard to, you know, the kind of the startup Silicon Valley culture. And I think that's certainly there. And obviously, like, the most distilled, concentrated, grossest version of capitalism that we can, you know, discern in our current day. But also, like, you know, I feel like all the mystery building, and maybe this is just because it's the show I want it to be, but I feel like the mystery box aspects of it are like the sugar to help the medicine go down. Cause I actually think deeper stuff is, I feel like deeper stuff is happening. Like, there's a point when, in the first episode, they go into it. There, a bunch of guests at this party are hiding from the robot rampage in the stable. And a host, Sable Boy, comes in, and you know, there's like debate, like, he's not going to do anything. He seems fine. Let's just leave him. Versus, no, we can't leave any host alive. And Jeffrey and Arnold tries to get it, or Bernard, whichever one it is. Bernard, I guess.
Yeah,
Bernard gets in the middle of it and tries to stop them killing this Sable Boy host, which they eventually do. And the Tessa Thompson character, whose name is
Charlotte.
Thank you. And Charlotte tells him, don't sacrifice yourself for the merchandise. And so I just thought, like, to me, this is like the story of Westworld is a story of like building this world where your workforce is expendable. Like, this is like humans. It's another slave story, except, you know, the slaves are robots instead of people. Or are they people? Like, that's, I mean, I get your dorm room critique, and I agree. Like, a lot of that is like super chewy and dumb, but there's something there. Like, this is an interesting question to consider. Like, what makes a person, what is personhood? You know, what is personhood in this context?
Yeah. No, I think it's definitely an interesting question, and one that was in, what was the Joaquin Phoenix, Her,
yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That I think was an interesting question. And then I love the way that they solved it, where they're like, well, you know, artificial intelligence's consciousness is not something that humans can even understand. So we're just not even going to bother with it. Like, that is very elegant. Good for you. Go smoke some more pot. Mm-hmm. I definitely think it's like, it's not an unworthwhile question to contemplate, but I do feel like in the average 58-minute episode, at least 8 minutes are spent in these somewhat clumsily done musings.
For sure.
That I wish they were doing it better. I think it's worth doing. I just am like, get on with it. So, yeah.
I mean, I think humans does it better for being in a less.
Oh, yeah.
For being a less fantastical setting. But by the same token, I also think, you know, the Westworld setting brings in more elements that are interesting to think about in terms of like how important, like the lengths that people in this universe will go to distract themselves, like how gross it is that this theme park has to be this way. Not to mention the environmental rape aspect of it, of like they terraformed this whole property on an island to look like the dusty plains. Like how much horror is actually inherent in this idea.
Presumably that is like somewhere in China because of like the Chinese military is there or something. Yep. So that's like a lot of work to make it look like that. Tara, I think your capitalism thing, you'll know it's really about capitalism when the hosts have like in-app purchases, you know, where you get to the park and you can fuck a robot if you want to, but if you want to do something crazy, it's like another $99. And then, you know, you just...
Or you can just ask your friends on Facebook for another life.
Right.
Yeah. And they're the butt crack of the robot is also a credit card.
Right.
Swipe. Mm-hmm.
Swipe it. Sure.
Or no, you can just use Apple Pay, you guys.
Yeah. But the way that they I think they are sneaky in the way that they are conveying these ideas. Like the other scene that really creeped me out in the premiere was when we see the lab and we see the two blank hosts. Rebuilding a third one. It's like, they're replicating themselves. Like this is very bad news. Like this is really, and closing on the shot of like all of the drowned hosts in the bay or whatever. It's like, okay, this is the end of labor according to capitalism. Anyway, obviously, this is my own hobby horse.
I
don't think it's just your hobby horse, Tara. I think that that's probably an accurate sort of take on it. You know. Like that they're in the thing is, and I think that you see that in episode two, which we won't go into too much, that sort of the message is that we as human beings expect corporations to take care of us and care about us. And of course they don't. I mean, Flint, Facebook, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. Corporations don't give a shit about you and they'll let you die if it means the bottom line. But, and so that they are sneaking it in the way that they are sort of sneaking in it in at that angle, but then they aren't trusting us to understand the other stuff with the dorm room stuff, which like the thing is Westworld has a proven track record of being able to trust their fans. See season one and how tiresome so many fans were with, you know, trying to unravel everything. They have probably one of the most engaged fan bases in terms of people who are dissecting every single line, which means we don't actually need that kind of exposition unless like somebody sort of higher up somewhere said, you know, that they needed to sort of broaden their base. Maybe that's the issue.
Yeah. To me, that's the least interesting part. Like the idea of like, there's a puzzle here to solve. Like who cares? Yeah. Like, just let me watch the show. I don't want to do extended reading. Like this is, this is asking too much of me.
I like the puzzle. Like,
we don't have
stuff.
To review Neuromancer. We get it.
Yeah. We got it. I mean, I like watching Ed Harris be a badass. He's so good at all that stuff. He's so good with a gun. You know, he's so good. Like, it's very difficult to tell when, I mean, because Ed Harris is 67. It's very difficult to tell when it goes from Ed Harris to the stuntman, because we can't ask Ed Harris to roll around on the ground. And he is selling the physical stuff very well. He's selling all of that. He's definitely more likable this season than he was in season one. I think that it helps that now we know that he is also young William, who was more sympathetic in season one and is growing steadily less sympathetic, young William, in this season. And I think that, but it's just like I feel like they're separating us from the characters, barring Ed Harris's character, the man in black, a little bit more with all of this sort of speechifying. And I wish they'd let us connect with them more, especially to Charlotte, Tessa Thompson's character, who looks like she's going to have a larger role. She's a great actress. And I think that, you know, she's very enjoyable, but I also think that she can be very bad, like she was on Veronica Mars. I think that Tessa Thompson needs a good director. And so I'm concerned about sort of the hand and the direction she's getting as the show progresses.
I thought they had some nice touches with her in the premiere where we, and you called this out in your recap as well, where at a certain point, like it's just without fanfare, we see that she has ditched her party shoes for boots.
Yep.
And then later just
pouring sand out of them.
Yeah. Later changes out of the dress into like just the cater waiter outfit. I think you called it Eve, which is like completely like this is a practical character. She has a different perspective on things. She's able to bring us into the story in a different way. Her and Maeve were my favorite characters. The problem with episode two, spoiler, is that there's not nearly enough Maeve.
I agree.
Yeah. Tara, I want to go back to something you said about the timeline of the show, like in the world. Mm-hmm. Because there's also something about, like, given who was elected, there's something even more like this is supposed to be not, you know, escapist entertainment. Well, maybe, but it's also supposed to be thought provoking. But I wonder how it would be landing with us now if we weren't being governed, if you can fucking call it that, by someone who has never met an impulse he wouldn't take. And who seems to be leading by the example that there's really nothing that you can do that's so bad that people will, you know, finally organize to try to get rid of you. Like, there's just this sort of like end of the like far end of the hedonism, self-absorption bell curve that we all, you know, live in, that this show is not for. So I wonder if the election had gone differently in 2016, how we would feel about seeing sort of this like uprising of the exploited, and if it would like would we feel differently about it? I don't know. I wish I knew, but there is no way to know. But I wonder
we would just be likening it to Occupy instead, I think, as opposed to like the resistance.
Right.
You know, but also, if, you know, in sort of the Westworld world, if who was quote unquote governing us was actually governing them, they wouldn't have had to go to China. They just could have built that all in the real Monument Valley and, you know, just done it all there. You know, the president would have given them the green light and said, go for it, and just given
put
them
it on
the
land they took back from Bear's Ears. Yeah. I mean, the question, it's an interesting question. And I'm curious to see if season two shows us more of like the world that they're that they are escaping from, because we see a little bit of that in episode one, but a little bit more in episode two. Like, what is this? What is the reality that they are trying to, that they are willing to like amuse themselves to death to not acknowledge or to not engage with? So yeah. I mean,
is it going to be a like Truman Show situation where they sail to the edge of the property and it's just like the edge of a dome.
Right.
Like, yeah. Guess we'll find
out.
But
this is also like, this is a common feature of dystopic narratives. Like, you see this in Oryx and Crake as well, where it's sort of like, you know, the rich will be able to insulate themselves in all kinds of ways we can't imagine. And this is one, you know, like,
yeah.
Anyway, cheerful.
So yeah. Cheery. So are you going to keep watching the season, Tara?
I think I am. I'm interested. I'm interested to see how they develop it. I don't know if I'll go back necessarily and watch season one, because I know the story of it. So, but maybe.
Right.
I think I'll keep watching.
I'm probably just going to follow along with Eve's recaps.
Eve's recaps are excellent. We'll do a pre-plug now for them so that she can plug something else later. But yes. Definitely Indeed. Go to previously.tv and check them out. You can also hear us read them on the previously.tv podcasts recap. No, I fucked it all up. The Epic Old School Recaps podcast. I like how the Teddy character, the James Marsden character, is playing what's traditionally the girl role, in that he's the one who doesn't know what's happening and has to have everything explained to him. That's funny to me. He's also attractive to my eye.
Yeah.
Dear Mr. President, there are too many states nowadays. Please eliminate three. I am not a crackpot.
My esteemed colleague Tara Ariano tackled the Simpsons' disappointing response to criticism of the Apu character on last week's podcast. I couldn't agree with her remarks more, but as a person who's finished with people who propagate backward thinking through snowflakey whining about political correctness, I no longer find it ethical to watch The Simpsons. But as a person who hates things that suck, I actually stopped watching it years ago. I'm not alone in this. A Forbes analysis from this time last year shows that The Simpsons is down from 27 million viewers per season that they once enjoyed to 4 million in 2016. Now, a lot of that, of course, is because TV viewerships changed and fragmented, and we're getting you know, fewer viewers on everything. But still, I think that we can say that The Simpsons is definitely in a slump. Here's another way I can say this. That April 8th episode that was so troubling charted only 2.15 million viewers, which means, you know, only nearly half, you know, in the next 2 years. God, listen to me, I'm a mess. But anyway, that's about par for the course in the show's 29th season. They're getting about 2.1 million viewers every episode. It was back in November of 2016 that the show's run was extended to 30 seasons, which means that contractually we have a year to go with this shit, not counting all the reruns. I know. I'm hopeful that that's the end of the line for the show, but I get it. No one wants to remember it as the person who cancels The Simpsons, especially in this era of social media harassment, swatting, and, you know, even worse. Fox needs a tough, powerful person to be the face of this decision, and that person is Ryan Murphy. Stick with me. I've always felt a kinship with Ryan Murphy. He grew up about 45 minutes from where I did. He graduated from a notoriously tough public school in Indianapolis in 1983. Yeah, yes, he's older than me. And get this. He came out while he was in high school, for which he was thrown into a therapy practice that's sort of known locally as a conversion joint. Long before Mike Pence was even around, we had these things in Indianapolis. So, you like his shows or not, you've got to respect him. This man was forged in fire. And from that, after a period in journalism, he became Fox's arguably greatest asset, both via broadcast shows like Glee and his many FX hits. If you haven't watched the trailer for Pose yet, this is the 1980s New York trans and gay ballroom culture show. You've got to go do that now. Its June premiere could not come soon enough for me. So, what if Fox and Murphy agreed to a WWE-level scripted standoff where he refused to bring any of his future work to the network unless The Simpsons was put out of its misery? Fox would have their bad cop to blame. Murphy would get credit for upholding excellence, enough to perhaps erase the bad taste the new normal left in many of our mouths. And before you say, well, that's not how things are done, guess what? It's Trump's America. And with that becomes an anything-goes attitude that thus far has only benefited those who despise things like diversity, equality, and fairness. Ryan Murphy is uniquely positioned to be the face that drains the stinking swamp that is the Simpsons. I am not a crackpot.
Wow. Powerful. You're not a crackpot.
No. That was also, there were twists and turns in that story. I had no idea where it was going.
It's crazy
to think. But I like where it ended up.
It's crazy to think that The Simpsons has been on for like twice as long bad as it was good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, more than that, if you consider the first couple of seasons that were like, the first season was not good. The second season was okay. Like, it takes a while for The Simpsons to actually get great. And its great run is surprisingly short. And then it just kept happening.
Like this segment.
Is this worse than jazz?
Pretty sure it is worse than jazz, because it is jazz. I'm speaking, of course, of the Bosch theme, which enjoyed a little, I don't think it was ever trending on Twitter quite, but a number of Bosch watchers and critics were like, this hateful theme song is stuck in my head. The Harry Bosch character is a big jazz fan. It's not annoying jazz the way that Carrie Matheson's jazz fandom was. It's actually like pretty old school stuff, like piano jazz. It's at least unobtrusive. But the theme song by Caught a Ghost, eye roll, is both a total earwig and squawky in the worst jazz way. So I put it to my fellow panelists. Is the Bosch theme worse than jazz? Dave, hit it with that clip, if you please.
Is this real?
Yep.
Yeah.
what the back half of that was, but the first half of that was let's do House of Cards with jazz. More jazz.
Yeah. And then the back half was like, let's take some magnetic poetry words and just repeat them over and over again while, I don't know, looking pained and feeling chilly. This is a really good show that, despite the jazz predilections of its protagonist, deserves better than this theme song. I think it probably is worse than jazz. What say the rest of ye?
I've heard worse jazz.
I have too. The beat makes it less loathsome. It's still bad. But it's not bad the way jazz is traditionally bad to me.
Eve? Okay. It sounds like the theme song for The Shield that they like dumped and did like, said, oh no, we'll just do the screaming instead. I don't know. It sounds dated and crappy. And also, I feel that people who like jazz are worse than jazz. So its association with Bosch taints it for me.
Okay. Thank you for your input.
It is time to go around the dial. Our first off is Tara Ariano. Tara, what do you have to take?
It's a big week for dystopias because The Handmaid's Tale is also back this week on Hulu for season two. And this is this time that we are going to be off the map. We concluded season one of the show with the way the novel on which the series is obviously based. The end of the season one finale is the same as the end of the book. Where Offred is being apprehended and we don't know what happens to her. And the book has kind of an epilogue that sort of is suggestive, but it leaves it very ambiguous in the novel. So I was concerned about this because for obvious reasons, but, the season two premiere is pretty good. I will try to not be too spoily because I believe that it drops the same day as this podcast, but, The flashbacks of this episode take us through a time that seems relatively early. The Gilead is established and the coup in the U.S. happens in the flashback times. But before that very day, in fact, June and her husband, Luke, discuss whether she should go off her birth control. And already things have gotten bad at this point, like he has to sign her prescription before she can get it filled. There's a line on the form for husband. So not great. But it also like it speaks to the crazy optimism that people have to reproduce even in an apocalypse. Like see also A Quiet Place. That's not really a spoiler, but like there are times to have a baby. I feel never is a good time, but like how you judge when things have gotten so far off the rails that you should just give up. Like, I don't think anyone ever gets there. And this thread of the story sort of is interesting to me in that respect. But it builds out the world more. We start to get hints of that we're going to get to see what the colonies are like, which in the novel are only referred to as the place where they send unwomen. So the ones that are not even of any kind of use to the regime go there and, you know, clean up toxic waste until they die. So someone may get to see that this season. We also get another character who decides that living is not worth it. And that is kind of grim too, but like realistic, I felt like there was not enough of that in season one of like, why aren't more people killing themselves? Like, it's weird to say that about a show. Like I wanted to see more suicides, but like, seriously though.
Well, I mean, you're a known, let's skip the apocalypse truther. It's like, cyanide capsule in the secret belt of, belt compartment.
Oh, sweet heavenly father!
You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. That's all I'm saying. Like, it's interesting. And they find a reason for Offred to have to cut her hair extension. So I'm sure that's a relief to Elizabeth Moss also, but, are the bad music cues back? Yes. And there's another instance in the premiere where a song that is very well known and from the 1980s gets slightly edited. So three makes a trend. So no one steal that story. I'm going to pitch it somewhere, but, The Handmaid's Tale still good. I'm hopeful that season two is going in an interesting direction, but it's still impossible to get to those end credits and see this was directed by a man and written by a man. Come on now, show, do better. Like of all times to not make this kind of work available to female creative people, like, it's a little ridiculous. I would love to, and I feel like the creator of the show knows it, because I never see interviews with him. His name is Bruce Miller. And I feel like it came out at a time where he was like, oh, fuck, I really should not be in charge of this. But, like, now he is. And so I just wonder if that's why he, like, decorously keeps himself scarce.
Willie hears ya. Willie don't care.
For my plug, I'm going to mention Bride and Doom. It will not be off next week because we are finally at the end of the season. So as this extra hot great drops, the finale podcast will have just gone up last night, and we'll be covering the reunion as well. And once again, much as in season 5, people have made decisions and some of them are bad, and Brian and I are mad. So check those out.
Eve, what do you... Oh, my God. Eve, what do you have?
So professional.
Dave, did I kill you? I'm sorry. I'd like to talk about Splitting Up Together. Splitting Up Together is based on a Danish sitcom I will not attempt to pronounce the name of, but it might as well have been created by someone who read a trend piece on a Swedish parenting and maybe kind of missed the point. Swedish parenting, which is sometimes called Scandinavian parenting, might... The IKEA jokes are all over the place, but that's not what it is. It's the idea that parents who can't make cohabitation work rotate in and out of one specific home. The kids remain in one place, and the parents are the ones who go in and out. Studies have suggested that this type of situation during separation or divorce is less damaging to the kids than the old school sort of arrangement where, like, one parent keeps the house and the other sets up digs in a shitty condo or whatever. It's an atypical enough arrangement in the U.S. that there's plenty of room for all sorts of comedy. So I was really psyched at the idea of this show, in which two divorcing parents trade off between parenting their three kids and their massive and gorgeous craftsman, and otherwise, the other one lives the single life in a converted garage. I really like the cast. Jenna Fischer plays the mom. She's approachable and funny. I like seeing Diane Farr, who plays Fischer's sister, get to be funny. And there's a young actress named Olivia, and I apologize if I mispronounce his last name, Cavill. She plays the couple's tween daughter, May, and she's very funny. Oliver Hudson plays Jenna Fischer's ex-husband and co-parent. Unfortunately, he's playing that sort of cookie-cutter, giant adult man-baby that we get on pretty much every sitcom ever. Fisher's role as the mom is all too punctuated with shit about how she needs to loosen up and have some fun. Well, look, if you're trying to raise three kids with a giant man-baby, if you choose to have fun too, that's a story that ends in mugshots. A few episodes in, it seems like this show is going to be a will they or won't they, but the quote-unquote suspense is whether or not the parents will reconcile. Is now that they're separated, they're starting to realize that they still love each other, and, gosh, I don't know. That said, you know, the writing is there. It is funny. There's a reason I'm still watching it as opposed to just watching it for 5 minutes. There are a lot of good bones there, so which is one of the reasons that I'm sort of frustrated, especially because... last week, there was all this bullshit about passion and how Jenna Fischer is getting to experience passion with her new hookup and how she and Oliver Hudson has sort of lost passion. And I'm like, what? You know, it's kind of irrational to think that after a decade together, any couple, quote unquote, like, can't not constantly grab each other's asses. See my earlier remarks in regard to mugshots. Yet the show is suggesting that if you don't feel the same level of hot to trotness you felt at the get-go of your relationship, it might be doomed. I really think that Splitting Up Together has a lot going for it. There are many very funny moments. I laugh aloud at least once, but I think that it's really like sort of screwing itself over by skipping what I think is sort of the most important thing that it could say, which is you can split up, you can break up, and still effectively parent. And in this sort of still sort of weird situation, it can be very, very funny. I am hopeful that the people who are working on the show will think seriously about whether or not it wants to be a standard sitcom. And keeping in mind that there are probably lots of other factors at play besides the people in the writer's room, consider the possibility of making this instead about Swedish parenting and actually getting divorced and making it work. There's fertile grounds for comedy in something like that. But if they don't sort of till that those fertile grounds for comedy, I'm concerned that Splitting Up Together is going to wither and die.
Well, I have a couple of comments because I watch it too. The aforementioned Brian, my co-host on Married at First Sight, is a writer on that show. So I will fully admit I am not unbiased, but I will say He has mentioned even on Married at First Sight, on Bride and Doom, how much network notes are you need to restate what your premise is. Like, you just have to keep reiterating what people's relationships are to each other and why they're doing this and what the idea is. So I think that I'm hopeful that after the first few episodes, like, they will get out of that rut where it seems like we're just hearing theses over and over again, like, as opposed to development.
Did you say theses or feces?
I said theses.
Not interested.
I also have some gossip, which is Diane Farr, who plays the Jenna Fisher character's sister, showed up at the premiere party with Hugh Laurie. So he's not trying to have Scandinavian parenting with his ex-wife. Did not know he was divorced, but that's what I hear.
Playing the banjo. Yeah, what am I plugging? Those of you who live in the Bay Area, many of whom have contacted me personally to say how sad they are that SFist, the site that I wrote for, is no more, will be happy to hear that I am now editing a San Francisco News newsletter. It's called Inside San Francisco, and sorry, that's the dog. You can find it at inside.com/SF. It's a every day during the week, you're going to get between 9 and 10 in the morning Pacific time, you're going to get my take on sort of the top news stories in the Bay Area that day. And, you know, I don't like riff or anything too much the way I do here, but it's still, you know, I tell it to you straight and I'm giving you what you need to know. And I am hopeful saving you some time from just going through your RSS feed and feeling more and more angry at what's going on with the SFMTA or scooters or whatever else. So Inside San Francisco, if you're interested. Thank
you. We'll link that in the show notes.
Hello. I'm here to talk about Unforgotten, the latest Britstory that has been transplanted via Masterpiece Mystery to the U.S. Series 1 of Unforgotten just wrapped up this past Sunday on PBS. Check your local listings. It should be on demand and on the app. Series 1 is about a literal skeleton from a 70s cold case, which they call a history case or a historical case in the U.K., which I love. It unearths more secrets than anyone bargained for, because otherwise you don't have a show. Some of the personal life parallels with the lead DCI's widowed father are a bit much, but overall, Unforgotten is just a thing for those of us still waiting for a new series of Happy Valley, and the acting is really great. Not least because, a la so many European projects of this and every other nature, it gives actors over 35 the right to exist, have feelings, and fuck. All ages have a chance to shine and be beautifully human, not just contoured folk who are 28 years old that you would never buy as a police sergeant. Tom Courtney, nominated for an Oscar way back in the day for The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner, is particularly amazing as Eric Slater. Our esteemed colleague Linda Holmes recommended this one over at NPR's Monkey See recently, and I thank her for it. And you can jump in at Series 2 this coming week. It usually airs Sundays on your local PBS station. But again, check your local listings. My plug is that I will be appearing on Crime Writers On's Patreon-only, I think, book club episode with Rebecca Lavoie. I am very excited about it. We'll be talking about David Grant's Killers of the Flower Moon. I'm very excited to, quote, have to read that. It's been on my list for a while.
Oh, it's really good. I read that.
Yes. Yeah. Actually, all David Grant is good. I recently finished, coincidentally, The Lost City of Z. Mm. And it's outstanding. He writes for The New Yorker. He's great. Yes, Crime Writers On's Patreon book club, featuring me in the next couple of weeks. And you can always follow me on Twitter at Tomato Nation if you want better updates closer to the time.
And now we have a message from Hannah.
Hannah recently moved away from St. Louis and misses her annual bowling party with her friend Anne. So Hannah wants to show Anne how much she misses her by making sure Anne raises the most money in the Gateway Women's Access Fund Bowl-a-thon fundraiser.
Abortion access in Missouri is prohibitively expensive for a lot of people who need safe and reliable reproductive health care. Anyone who needs an abortion must travel to one of the three clinics in Missouri that provide the service, meet with a doctor, wait 72 hours, and meet with the same doctor again. Often this is all just to be prescribed a pill. just for a pill, a person has to miss work, pay for travel expenses, and pay out of pocket, since insurance is not permitted to cover abortion services, all to make a choice about their own goddamn bodies and health.
The Gateway Women's Access Fund provides the financial assistance that many people need to afford an abortion. Plus, they come up with really awesome team names. So support Anne and the rest of her team, the Ruth Bader Ginsburgs, by donating at bowl.nnaf.org/fundraiser/133-5180. And yes, that will be in the show notes, not to worry, in case you weren't scribbling that down in the car.
Good luck, Anne.
That means it is time for the canon Eve is submitting today. Take it away, Eve.
Hi, guys. I think we all know that canon submissions need to check off a couple boxes. First, they need to be from a show worthy of canon inclusion. Then they need to accurately represent the show. Then they need to include an element that hits a high note for the series. If I'm wrong about any of that, don't tell me now, because I already wrote this whole thing out. I'm going to argue today that this episode of Flipping Out, which is Flipping Out Season 3, Episode 7, entitled Irreconcilable Differences, does all three. First, is Flipping Out as a show worthy? Well, it's certainly not going to inspire Dave to respond with a 4.5-minute podcast meditation on a condiment, which to some might be a point in its detriment. But I do believe that Flipping Out is a noteworthy show, especially because in its earlier seasons, before it was all about other people's babies. It was a part of Bravo's early wave of shows we might describe as a, quote-unquote, let's follow a kind of awful person with a kind of interesting job around with the camera. It's also one of the most successful in that genre. You guys, this fucking show has been on for 11 years. Kell on Earth, comparatively, got 8 episodes. The show focuses on Jeff Lewis, who, especially back when this episode aired in 2009, had a dual business of flipping upper-middle-class/lower-upper-class homes in Los Angeles. He also took on interior design gigs. Jeff is basically who Larry David might be if he were a real person, often saying whatever he wants, goading people around him for his own amusement, and with an obsessive desire to pick at issues that often acts to his detriment. He's a legitimately unusual person with an interesting job that the show devotes just enough processy attention toward. This episode has all the hallmarks of a classic Flipping Out episode. Jeff's attention to detail, as I know you noticed, Tara, appears as he reflexively adjusts and straightens items. We get a scene of Lewis and his fit and lovely staff eating as they apparently do every day, disgusting-looking fast food at a dining room table, straight out of the carry-out containers.
It's like, and it's the worst. It's usually like Del Taco. Like, he's always got a plastic, reusable cup.
Yeah.
He eats horrible. I don't know how he looks like that. Maybe
it's
he only
like
eats
not
one
even
meal
Chipotle.
A day.
Yeah. It's so gross. And this is one of those things that they're still doing even now. And it's like, mm-hmm. How everyone looks so amazing and they eat all this shit, but out of the carry-out containers. They don't even put it on a plate. This makes me crazy. We also get lots of shots of Jeff's many adorable pets. We get to hear him fuck with his staffers, especially Zoila, who's his housekeeper/mother figure. Here's an interaction between the two in clip one.
Zoila, we got a problem up here.
Where?
Come here. Look.
Where? Let me see.
You have to move furniture around. Look
okay,
at this.
Okay, you...
Zoila, look.
I'm scared moving that.
Zoila, why are you scared? It's on a bracket. Look at this. This is ridiculous.
It's just ridiculous by cleaning today.
All you do, look, you're just making up excuses. Oh, Jeff,
don't
I would have cleaned.
Chris, don't laughing. Make a joke.
It's not funny. That's dirt.
Okay, it's dirty. Okay. I'm cleaning.
No more excuses.
Shut up, Jeff.
Another Flipping Out box to check off is a wacky interaction with an obnoxious design client who's all too aware of the camera. This time the client is Brad Sherwood, who a quick Google search tells him he is a Q-list actor, I did huge air quotes just then, guys, who's been on Whose Line Is It Anyway? He's been a panelist on tons of game shows, and he's one of those people on, like, I Love the 80s or whatever. He and his wife appear to have a ton of free time and use some of it to pick at Jeff, whom they hired as an, quote-unquote, audition to install some outdoor lighting to their home. Here's his wife, Sienna, so you know what kind of folks we're working with. Dave, can I have clip two now, please?
We're so, like, just annoyed with it beyond. It's maddening. So we want people that are of your kind to be mindful and precise and grand. Operate from a place of excellence.
I know,
LA.
Right? Well, Brad and Sienna are certainly gold standard Flipping Out clients. The situation that makes this episode particularly canon-worthy, is the painful and, in my opinion, genuine argument between Jeff and his former significant other turned sometime business partner Ryan Brown. Brown, Jeff says, is engaging in questionable SEO activity. Maybe he's buying Jeff Lewis Google search keyword ads or something like that. The way Jeff describes it, it's clear that Lewis doesn't quite understand the issue, if there actually is one. But he's freaking out in the way only a person who doesn't really understand the internet can freak out about internet-y things, as you can hear in this third clip.
There was much bigger issues. Ryan started this very vague, deceptive website where you thought you were reaching me. But someone at Brown Design would pick up the phone and they would speak to you if you were a potential client. You know, you can't trust your best friend. Well, who do you trust after that? No one. No one. I was starting to become all too consumed with this. And I was driving myself crazy. So I think I needed to have a sit down.
Oh, wow. It wasn't until I listened to that just now that discordant sort of like early 90s guitar there, too. That was, it's like Sonic Youth or something. So when Jeff and Brown sit down to have their discussion, it feels clear. And I could be gullible. You guys tell me if you think I am, but I feel like this really wasn't just for the cameras. Jeff is agitatedly pacing. He's downing a glass of wine like it's hemlock. Watching it now, one realizes how dire things were for home flippers during that market crash in the late aughts. You don't get this kind of darkness on, say, like Flipper Flop, and that's a show where the guy has guns. So, in my opinion, this fight isn't staged. It still sort of feels like a play. Jeff spotlit from above in a way that evokes, dare I say it, I will dare, Othello, a similarly conflicted figure who also made grave decisions based on a faulty understanding.
Ryan, if that ended up being three jobs,
okay,
that you got using my name, that, in my opinion, is stealing. Meanwhile, your business is exploding. You're hiring more people using, and I don't, so you're, I have
okay.
no proof.
Okay.
I have
so,
no proof.
Okay, so that's, I think, the most important yep. thing, that you have no proof because no proof yep. exists. I'm listening to you, Jeff. It's not fair to fault me for being a smart businessman.
Ryan, for 10 years, I shared business with you that I didn't have to do.
You're totally
Do you know
right.
how many sweet deals I came up and with I, and gave you half? I found all the properties. And I made you rich.
Okay.
So then when the business went to and your business is flourishing and I'm starving like I was last year, you did not share anything with
not
me.
Not true.
10 years, 40 houses, I found every okay. one of those deals, and I shared them with you.
Okay, but every... Oh,
then when the market
on,
took
on.
A dump,
what about
you
job?
Gave me a garage remodel that was $10,000. Thank you very much.
Okay.
What we don't see, since this is a podcast, is at the end of that, Jeff sits down in his chair. His little dog's behind him, and he puts his hand on the dog. It's really sort of sad because... Yeah, the Othello comparison's a bit much. No one was murdered, but as a result of this conversation, Ryan and Jeff did indeed, for real, part ways, both business-wise and as friends. The pair met again at a really awkward reunion special at the conclusion of this season, but Ryan was not back on the show for season 4. Jeff, who we saw in episodes besides this one, clearly loved Ryan's young daughter, didn't see her again for years, he said in subsequent interviews. So I'm submitting this episode because it not only offers a classic characterization of the show, but because in its final minutes, we see some quote-unquote, like, some real reality. I think about this episode a lot as I, and I suspect I'm not alone here, have been on both sides of interactions like this one. Thanks to this episode, when I've been on the Jeff side, I've been able to check myself and realize the damage I'm about to cause. I think that very few other shows on Bravo, especially those in the let's follow kind of awful person with a kind of interesting job around with the camera, sort of genre, could make that same claim. So that's why I'm submitting it to the canon. I turn it over to you. Thank you.
Sarah, you should go first because I think you don't watch the show and I do.
You are correct. I don't watch the show. I feel like that might have been an oversight on my part. And then I've devoted too much of my Bravo TV watching budget to maritime adventures of various below decks. I actually regret nothing in that regard. But... Yeah, this is very watchable, except for Jeff's lips, which are disturbingly
Yeah,
acceptable.
Jeff's lips are crazy.
It's too much filler, so it goes inside out. I know, I hate that.
Yeah, and it looks like it's sticking to his canines in like a painful way. But yeah,
And also Ryan's hair. Like, I just wanted to go back in time through the TV and slap it off his head. I just can't. This is like classic sort of old school, even though this episode is what, 10 years old, not even like 9 years old. It's it just feels like it's from another like era of reality TV. And after you watch enough like Real Housewives of New Jersey, where you literally can't trust anything that's happening, this actually felt like documentary by comparison. And the build of it is really good. They're really smart about what they include. Like, I'm so glad that you pulled that clip, the operate from a place of excellence clip. It's just like, oh my God. But I think that maybe the canon is like a little, I think that entries that address the like televisual preoccupation with the real estate market in all its multifarious facets, maybe that segment has been underserved, because there's just something about this like $1 million listing. I can't commit to watching it on a regular basis because my husband lives it and I have to like hear about the draw. And actually he like was in a play with Ryan Serhant, weirdly. So I'm like, okay, we have to watch the new Ryan Serhant TV show. And he's like, no, we don't. And if you try to make me, you can live on the roof. But there is something very, I don't know, like, you know, it's bad for you about this kind of show, but it like tastes so delicious while you're eating it. So yeah, this was a very enjoyable watch. I don't, like, I feel like I've been missing out on flipping out, but I also feel like I probably shouldn't watch too much more of it. But one of my canon criteria, as everyone knows, is that if I wanted to watch another one right after, that's a good sign. So yeah, this was fun. I mean, are there seasons in which his lips are not quite so?
No,
no, oh.
No. His lips are just like that now.
Okay, so maybe I should just like listen to the show in the future. Yeah, I mean,
but then you miss the reveals. You get used to the lips.
Yeah. Like, it didn't feel as forced as Bravo shows can feel now. He's like a pretty crappy guy, I guess, but I think, you know, I wouldn't refuse to let him use my bathroom kind of crappy. No, like, he's not a monster. There was some processy stuff about like the project. His internet ignorance is hilarious. Zoila is hilarious. Yeah, it was a fun hour, but I don't know obviously where it ranks in the like firmament of flipping out. So I'm going to turn it over to Tara.
Well, I've watched every episode of the show. It's worth noting that there was more of a, this was like almost a mini franchise, not quite like the Housewives shows, but like there was also Blowout and Workout. Like, this, where, yes, they were trying to get an workout out thing going on. And yeah, the other two did not last. This one did last. It was, as Eve said, airing new episodes as recently as last year, I think was the last season. And this was it was pleasurable to me to revisit this one. The Sherwoods are the worst. I mean, I saw their point about like the bits of plastic being left around their yard that their dogs could pick up. But like, if you're going to go to the trouble of, as Jeff said, like walking the whole multi acres of your property to pick up every single one so that you can present them on a tray, like, just fire him if you're that mad about it. Like, I get where you're coming from, but like, as Jeff says, he and they speak the same language, which is passive aggression. So like, finally someone had to pull the trigger in that relationship and be like, this is not working. And Jeff does it, I think, in that interaction as well as one can.
Totally.
When he's basically saying like, your money is not worth it, the hassle that you're putting me through. Like, I can't be here every day looking at your fucking yard lights. Sorry. Because they're very LA and they are the worst. He was on Whose Line Is It Anyway around the same time as Charles Esten. So I'm sure it's very painful for him to see where his former colleague has ended up relative to himself. But yes, the obviously the centerpiece of this episode is the fight with Ryan. And I actually didn't think he was that clueless about about the internet aspect of it, my understanding, based on what we see, and who knows how manipulated that is that Ryan registered jefflewis.com and then set up Brown Designs there, because there's a shot where you see him enter it and that's where it goes.
Well, I watched like the previous episode just to remind myself of the situation so I could, so I could sort of comment a little more knowledgeably on this. And it seems more, based on the previous episode, that we're talking about Google Ads, where when you search Jeff Lewis, that the top, like, sort of, remember like how Google Ads were a little different back then? So it seemed like it was more of that sort of deal. And he was like using keywords. Remember keywords?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. The point is, Ryan is being sketchy. And when he's like, you can't fault me for being a smart businessman, like, yeah, but this is shitty. Like, you know what you're doing. You're being deceptive. You are trying to route people who are looking for Jeff to you. And that's shitty. Like, if his counterclaim to Jeff's anger is, you know, we helped each other and I have sent business your way, like, yeah, but how much have you snaked from him? Like, this is the question. So the thing, the motif of the show throughout the many seasons is that Jeff gets really angry and paranoid about shit, but then Jeff is always right. And of course, that's how they can construct the season to go that way, because by the time they're editing it, they can go back and have him tape a bunch of interviews that have him like predicting stuff that ends, you know, the way he thinks it's going to. And sometimes that's actually traumatic for people who work for him, like Jenny, because in an earlier season, her husband, Chris, also worked for Jeff and was like being very unprofessional. I don't remember the specifics, but was like fucking around when he was supposed to be working. And Jeff puts in nanny cams and catches him. And Chris and Jenny end up getting divorced. Jenny is loyal enough to Jeff that she's like, I choose Jeff over husband. And who knows what else was also going on at the same time. But like, Jenny is still working for Jeff, at least on the show, you know, two pregnancies and another husband later. So, you know, Jeff is very abrasive and obviously not a super fun guy to be around all the time. But my theory about him is always that he's misunderstood because his sense of humor is extremely dry. So people think he's being extremely rude and insulting. And I think he's just joking and he's not getting that across. What does that say about me? That's an open question for you all to decide. With regard to this episode, though, I agree with Eve that that fight seems real. Jeff certainly seems mad. We don't know how much construction in the season, like, was how much foundation was laid after the fact to build up to this. And that's always the question, like, how much of this is Jeff being right and how much of it is Jeff knowing how to spin things in retrospect when they're already over. But she's also right that this is like it's taking us back to a very dark time in real estate in our recent history that we may soon return to. Who knows? Touch wood that we don't. But Ryan also, like, at this point has to sit through it because he signed the release. You can't unsign it, I guess. And so that's why he had to come back for the reunion and have to like sit through it again. And I also wonder, as seasons have gone on, like, if Gage, who is now Jeff's partner on the show and in real life and in the business, has this always in the back of his mind, like the Gage meta story of knowing Jeff probably through the show before he knew him in real life is fascinating to me. Like, gives the show a whole other dimension, like that Gage has to know at a certain point, like, I only can push Jeff so far, and then he might cut me out of his life like he has so many other people I have seen on Bravo, you know. there's a lot going on with the show is my point,
apparently. So, dang.
Yeah
you have to ask yourself, with people like Gage and like Jenny, how worth it is it to you to remain in Jeff's orbit? You know, what are the benefits? I do believe that Jeff is a loyal friend. I do believe, I mean, Zoila is another great example of that. I do believe that Jeff loves these people. It's weird because we're talking about real people with like real feelings and not characters. So like, I'm a little uncomfortable about with this, but I'm the one who started this podcast, this whole proposal anyway. But Jeff is like a real person. Like, I really view him as a real human being and not like a Kardashian or a housewife who's presented a packaged version of themselves. And he's also, the last time I looked, he's very amusing on Twitter. People will tweet sort of ask kissy things like, I'm the only one who gets you, Jeff, and he will destroy them. It's pretty great. So he's worth looking at there, too.
I mean, I wonder how much of the show is still real now. Like, I bet Jenny only works for Jeff when cameras are there. I doubt that she's there day to day doing his assistant shit still all these many years later. But that's another issue. Yeah. He's a fascinating reality TV character. And fights like this are why you watch the show. So excellent Ready presentation, show. Excellent selection and excellent presentation.
Thank you.
And all Dave right. is going to sit this one out because he is.
I'm on administrative flu leave. It's a sickness you get when you combine moving with a cold and having to deal with Time Warner cable cancellation and all that. And it makes you very sick and very dead. So with that, let's put this to a vote. Tara, what say you?
I vote yay.
And Sarah D. Bunting, what say you?
I also vote yay.
All right.
Oh.
That means flipping out season 3, episode 7, Irreconcilable Differences. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time for Winner and Loser of the Week. Tara has our winner.
Yes, our winner is Mary Shelley, who is going to be the subject of season 3 of Nat Geo's scripted series, Genius. Season 1 was about Albert Einstein, and I made it about 4 minutes into the premiere until they got to the point where they had to make sure you know this Einstein fucks, and I was like, pass. And then season 2 was about Picasso, and it was like, are these all going to be about men cheating on their wives while being good at something? Because pass, that's already what all premium cable is about. So I have not watched any more of the show since then. But Mary Shelley is a fascinating subject. If you get the New Yorker, you will have maybe recently read within the last few months a review of several of her books and a biography that sort of tells about the process of writing Frankenstein, which she did, and she really lived. And the people that were around her were also fascinating. It was a very weird literary time, and I'm curious to know what they do with her story. So good job, Nat Geo.
And Loser of the Week.
Lethal Weapon.
Yeah.
Well, really, Clayne Crawford. Deadline reported yesterday that apparently the show's future is in jeopardy because he's such a douche on the set, like complaints of emotional abuse and creating a hostile environment. And allegedly the issue has escalated to a point, quote, where other actors as well as crew on Lethal Weapon would feel uncomfortable being on set with him.
Fuck.
Yeah. And like, it's an action show. That's usually a pretty big set with a lot of people. A recasting is being explored, which is a pretty dire move. I think the show does pretty well for Fox, but apparently no one can deal with Clayne Crawford. The article does not say exactly what he's doing, but it kind of sounds like he's basically doing everything that's bad, and it's disappointing.
Yeah, he's putting his dick in the chip dip on craft services table. That's my guess.
Yeah. And his
I mean,
butt.
Channeling the guy who originated the role of Martin Riggs, maybe not a good play when you're Clayne Crawford. Like, you're
maybe the role is cursed.
Yeah, maybe. Like, but he's not famous enough to get away with this shit. No. You know what I mean? I mean, no one is, I guess. That's the lesson of the last year, but still, like, especially not him.
Yeah. I mean, I'm the only person who recognized him for basically both of his big roles.
Yeah.
From Inca Mummy Girl on Buffy and from Rectify. Like, dude. Yeah. Check yourself and Yikes. Do it anyway. I don't care how famous you are. Don't be dicking up the chip dip. It's a good
of
rule.
Of course. Yes.
Speaking about dicking up the chip dip, do you know what time it is?
French onion time?
It's Totito's time. Oh. Yeah. This game brought to you by Frito-Lays. All right, everybody. This is the second game time of the season. Sarah won the last game time, correct?
Yes.
Everything's coming up, Sarah. Today we are playing I Was Told There Would Be No Math by Greg on the Lamb, or if you prefer, Greg Rack of Lamb.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, who writes us to inform us of this game. Today, the game is called I Was Told There Would Be No Math, a game that combines your knowledge of TV numbers with dun 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 grade school math. You'll be given simple equations using TV info as your numbers, like, for example, what is the number of eyes on the face of Leela from Futurama, plus the number of the nickname of Olivia Wilde's character on House?
Oh, 14?
14. Yeah. That is 1 eye plus 13, the nickname, equals 14. That's how the game is played. There are 21 questions. We have a few tiebreakers if we need them. Okay, Tara, can you please tell us about the steel meal situation?
It's a real feast or famine steel meal situation in that I have one, the valued guest has one, and Sarah D. Bunting has 7.
Wow.
Thanks, right. Dave.
Yeah, no problem.
We will start with valued guest.
Picky as determined, our order will be Eve, Sarah, Tara. Are we ready to play I Was Told There Would Be No Math?
Yep.
Yes.
All right, Eve. The number of friends plus the number of lone gunmen.
10.
Incorrect. There are 6 friends and 3 lone gunmen. 9. Sarah D. Bunting. The sum of all the digits in the title of Shannon Doherty's most famous series.
12.
Correct. That's Beverly Hills 90210. And zeros
Sorry.
Count. You know how many zeros are? There's 0. Tara, Mystery Science Theater title number divided by the number in the address of Tina Fey's workplace comedy.
100?
100 is correct. Back to Eve. The numbers in the name of this Wachowski siblings sci-fi series multiplied by the number in the title of the series Numbers, which starred Rob Moreau and Judge Hirsch.
24?
Correct. That's Sense 8 plus Num 3ers.
Nice.
Back times to Sarah. The number of reasons why for the Netflix show plus the number of days at a time for the Netflix reboot.
14.
14 is correct. Tara.
Yes.
The number of sons in the 60s sitcom times the number of dads in the 80s sitcom.
6.
My 3 sons, my 2 dads. Eve.
Mm-hmm.
The number in the title of the Avery Brooks Star Trek series plus the number in the title of the oddly similar syndicated series about a space station created by J. Michael Straczynski. 1 plus the other.
Oh, it's plus. 18?
Incorrect.
That's steel meal.
Oh, steel meal. Blah 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 blah. Steel meal.
Wow, that was super exciting. I believe this is 14 again, right? Deep Space 9 plus Babylon 5, which I always confuse. Yeah.
Yep. Correct.
Well done.
All right. Now it is Sarah's actual question. The sum of all the digits in the title of Marla Gibbs and Jack A. Harry's 80s sitcom.
11.
2, 2, 7. Tara.
Yeah.
The amount of time described in hours by the titles of the 2 long-running CBS evening magazine shows. How many hours in the 2 CBS evening magazine shows? In hours.
Oh, hours. Okay, sorry. 108.
I'm curious what those shows are in your head. Go ahead.
60 minutes and 48 hours?
Yeah. And in hours, that would be 49.
Oh, Jesus.
Okay.
Sorry.
Eve Beatty.
Yes.
What's the average of these two numbers? The number of the apartment of Kristen Ritter as the titular B, and the number of the address in the Donny Depp High School Undercover show.
The average?
Yes.
Okay. 12.
Steel meal.
Oh, yep. My God.
22.
22. Don't trust the bee in apartment 23 and 21 Jump Street. Right in the middle.
I'm going to have to look up how to do averages. Okay, I think did I give you the median then?
Oh, I don't know.
No, it's immaterial. Would still be 22.
Shit. Okay.
Sarah Bunting. The number in the party of the Scott Wolf teen drama multiplied by the number of the grade containing kids that people may or may not be smarter than.
Okay. So are you smarter than a fifth grader? All right. And party of five. So 25.
Correct. All right. This will take us home to our first score break. This is for Tara.
Mm-hmm.
The number of feet under for Alan Ball's HBO show multiplied by the number that was enough for Dick 48. Van Patten. Not Dick Van Dyke, as it says in the question. Guys, come on. Yes.
Can I? May I?
48. Oh, for fuck's sake, yes. Please do answer.
48!
That takes it to our first score break. Tara's disqualified for being a jerk.
Sarah has 6 points. I have 3 points. Eve has one.
All right, 6-3-1. Of course, Tara can't win anymore, but let's continue to play. Eve Beatty.
Yes.
God.
It's a lot.
The number of dollars that Lee Major's bionic character was worth minus the number of lives to live in on the long-running soap opera.
So 5,999,999.
Well done.
Correct.
Thank
Sarah D. Bunting. The number of the Definite Article USA show about disappearing and reappearing people divided by the number of the Definite Article CW post-apocalyptic show.
What? Wait, I'm sorry. Divided by?
Yes. Divides evenly.
Okay.
Oh.
Oh, that thing. Okay, I hope it's the 4,400 divided by the 100, which means the answer is 44.
Were you thinking of the 9?
Yes. I was
Me
like,
too.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah. Like decimal points now? Fuck up game time.
Tara, the numbers in the name of Jerry Ryan's Star Trek Voyager character, plus the number of Millie Bobby Brown's character on Stranger Things. Add them all up.
23? She's not 7 of 9?
Yeah.
14 and 9 is not
23?
11! Fucking hell! So psyched out by this game.
Eve Beatty.
Yep.
The number of castaways in Gilligan's Island multiplied by the number of sisters in Charmed, including Rose McGowan.
Plot twist.
Okay.
Just sit right
including
back.
Including Rose McGowan. Okay. 35?
Incorrect. There's 7 castaways.
Right.
4 sisters. 28.
Okay. I miscounted castaways. Perhaps.
I miscounted sisters.
The professor, Marianne, Ginger, the Howells.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Skipper and Gilligan at 7. And, of course, the Heart of the Globetrotters. So actually, that's more like 32 now. All right. This is number 17.
Spread Eagle.
Spread Eagle.
The number of men in the title of the Charlie Sheen sitcom times the number of broke girls in the title of Kat Dennings sitcom.
5.
2.5 and 2 broke girls.
There were decimal points. God damn it.
Yes.
The number of the Aaron Sorkin comedy, and then there's a question mark there about a comedy show, minus the number in the title of the comedy that gave us Ashton Kutcher.
Aaron Sorkin minus Ashton Kutcher?
That's correct.
Negative 10?
Negative 10 is the correct answer.
Wow.
All right, this is Eve Beatty's very last question. ever. Mm-hmm. Uh-oh.
Yep.
What? Jesus. The number of Doctor Who's is, including the upcoming Jodie Whittaker, minus the number of Cylon types.
Hey, guess what, you guys? I've had sex. I don't know this one.
Now, I know Sarah's a big fan of Doctor Who and Battlestar Galactica. Do you want to take it steel mill here?
Nope.
14
Anybody,
doctors,
just for
right?
shits and giggles, want to guess?
14 doctors, right?
Nope.
Jodie Whittaker is the 14th?
She's the 13th.
She is?
Yes.
Okay. Then I don't know.
That's 13 minus 12. The answer is 1. All right, Sarah Bunting, here's your last question. The C-Lab number in the Adult Swim show minus the number of the long-running ABC news show anchored for decades by Baba Wawa.
I assume without the virgule in the center?
Yes, correct. We'll combine all those okay. into one big number.
Oh, wait. Shit.
What's that called? What's that thing called? What did you just call it?
It's a virgule.
Ooh, fancy.
Yeah. This is a family show. I actually don't remember that if it's 2020 or 2025. So I'm going to say 5.
Well, you're on the right track, but you had the number wrong. The very original C-Lab that was like the Hanna-Barbera cartoon that the Adult Swim was based on, that was 2020.
Right.
The Adult Swim is 2021. So the answer is 1. The answer is 1. All right. This is our last question. It is for Tara.
Ever.
Yep.
It's the last question ever. Mm-hmm. Only Sarah survives this game time. The total number of roommates in Three's Company history.
Oh, no.
Minus the total number of Charlie's Angels in history. We're just talking TV here, of course.
0?
Let's try to explain it. Let's see what.
Okay, Three's Company. There were three blondes, right? There were three different blondes plus
Chrissy,
plus Jack,
Cindy, and Terry.
Yes, plus Jack and Janet. That makes 5.
Yeah.
And Charlie's Angels. There were three originals, and I think they had two other blondes, so that makes 5.
You were very close. The answer is minus 1. There were 6 Charlie's Angels.
Damn it.
Jacqueline Smith, Cheryl Ladd, Kate Jackson, Farrah Fawcett, Shelley Hack. What a hack.
Yeah.
And Tanya Roberts.
Oh, that's the one I forgot.
Oh, sure.
All right. That is it. Let's hear the final scores.
Okay. Well, Eve had 2. I had a gentleman's 4. And Sarah wins with 7.
Oh, those steel wheels coming in handy for Sarah.
No kidding.
Yeah. Thanks, Dave.
All right, it's time to play some steel meal shits and giggles questions. I have 2 questions here. First person to shout out the answer for each one will win a steel meal. Eve will be playing for value guests. Are you ready for your first one?
Yes.
Answer only at the end of the question, please. The number in the title of the Jessica Biel CW show times the number in the title of the CW show starring Chad Michael Murray. Go.
6.
21.
No 6. Correct answers yet.
Oh, shit.
The number in the title, Jessica Biel's CW show, multiplied by the number in the title of the CW show starring Chad Michael Murray.
7. Oh, multiplied. 7.
Yes, multiplied. That is 7. And Tara got that. Okay. Last one. Here we go. This is just a number, not an equation. First, everybody gets a guess. Closest, Price is Right rules win.
Okay.
What is the number that appears in the scanner when Marge buys supermarket groceries at the checkout in the credits
8 million?
Of The Simpsons?
8 million.
Tara says 8 million. She's wrong.
800,000?
No, also wrong. I will say this.
8,000.
Okay, wow. No, nobody gets points for that one. The correct answer was $874.63.
Yeah. Oh. That's why The Simpsons should be canceled.
But look at this. Sarah's won again.
Sarah.
Congratulations, Sarah.
Thanks, math.
Woo.
Took a turn.
Finally. All right, everybody, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. God damn it. The sound playing?
Oh, it is.
Yes. I can hear it.
Ah! I hate my life. All right.
Hang on. Sorry. Problems over here, guys. Eve made the successful pitch for Flipping Out Season 3, Episode 7 for The Canon. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Sarah was the winner of this week's Game Time, extending her lead to 2 points this season. Remember,
all
guys.
All adds up.
We're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tari Ariano.
Shut up, Jeff.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Your house is gonna get screwed up, dude.
And Eve Beatty.
Oh, don't have any more cows, man.
Thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll see you week after next.
Space Pope.
Oh, my God. Let's record this whole thing over again. That was a disaster. God, so many buttons mispressed.
This has been a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.